Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network and our program Moving Forward on the third Sunday of each month. I'm your host, Kelly KJ Jones, brain injury survivor and now life coach. My co-host, Dr. Valentina, a bilingual clinical psychologist, is here to discuss the emotional aspects that coincide beyond our physical injury. Moving Forward will host candid discussions with persons who have experienced neuroinflammation and certified clinicians who have assisted survivors. Their insight on discovery, the line between pain tolerance and pain threshold, as well as pathways to success, will provide hope and more options on how to build momentum for a sustainable recovery. Dr. Valentina, are you here?
I am. Good evening, Kelly, Coach KJ.
Yes. Happy October.
Happy October. We're at fall, right?
Huh?
I said we're at fall, right? I think the official day was sometime in September.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Can I just tell you, I'm from New Jersey. And someone sent me a picture of a tree with these beautiful red leaves. I was like,
Yes. Love it. I'm seeing the red and some yellow and some orange. Just pretty. Love. Oh, just beautiful.
That's what I was going to ask you, but what are the trees like in Chicago? What else has been going on with you since the last time we spoke?
Oh, man, I have grown my private practice such that I now have 6 clinicians. Like,
what?
Boom. I know. I thank the Father. Like, this is absolutely something that I hadn't even envisioned. You know what I'm saying? Like, wasn't even in the plan as far as mine goes. And better than, of course, mine. You know what I mean?
He is always going above and beyond.
Yes, seriously. Seriously, we just have to keep from getting in the way. That's all.
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard, you know, because that's where our strength comes from, is getting in the way.
Mm-hmm.
But,
right.
Yeah, he's showing up and showing out. He's showing up and showing out in my life, too. Listen to this. So I have been working for an individual, and I've had an opportunity. I don't know if you know, background is public speaking. So I've had an opportunity to talk about everything from farming to education to domestic violence, and I have been loving it, loving it.
Wow, that is wonderful. Wow.
Yeah, and then when you get the affirmation, like one of my classmates said to me, he was like, he heard my speech on domestic violence and said it was excellent and just blew me away.
Wow.
So let me ask you this. So, are you ready for tonight?
I am. I am so excited.
Well, I sent you some of the info about our guest tonight. Her name is Tijuana Brown. A little bit about Tijuana before she joins us. Tijuana Brown, born and raised in Charlotte, North Carolina, high school cheerleader and track star with tons of family love and support, which made Thanksgiving and Christmas an all-time favorite. Her life took an unexpected turn. During her 20s, she was arrested. She spent 19 years in prison, and today She has the ultimate story of triumph and has turned her pain into purpose. Tia is a formerly incarcerated woman and a board member, active member of the National Council. Tia is a founder of Beauty After the Bars, a nonprofit organization based in Charlotte, North Carolina, Mecklenburg County. BATB, acronym for Beauty After the Bars, provides mentoring, advocacy, education, and support racial equity and economic mobility for the communities that are disproportionately affected and our most marginalized communities. Beauty After the Bar supports successful return of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated mothers, women, and girls. The mission and purpose of the organization is to provide education and advocacy to keep women, girls, and youth out of jail, prison, and the justice system. Basically, that's the general gist of it. I have her website also listed on the page. I just want to mention to you, once again, this young lady is a phenom, and she's beaten the odds. I just want to throw out a couple things with you. According to the Board of Justice statistics, 7% of individuals in prison actually are blind, and it increases to 15% as they age in prison. Number two, suicide. Federal offender average is, suicide is a leading cause of death. Actually, 30% of deaths in prison. Half of all who die between, in a 2000 to 2018 study, died in jail after less than nine days of being arrested. And PTSD, 60% after arrest, according to the Georgia Sun. So once again, she is a phenom. She is like the cheerleading office. She lifts everybody up. She's super duper motivational. Tia, are you here? Are you with us?
I am here, Kelly. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Welcome tonight.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I mentioned casually that you are so positive and uplifting. I mean, seriously, everybody kind of talks to Tia because she's so positive. Where did you get it from?
Where did I get it from? I mean, it's learned over the years. You don't always, you're not born with that. I mean, I've been that way for quite some time, but you have to work on adapting that in your everyday life with dealing with all the adversity, all the negativity in the world, all the opposition that we deal with as Black women, all of the things that goes on, all of the barriers, all the obstacles. So that's something that you have to build the bridge to. But something very important came out. I don't know how this typo got out there. 19 years, I didn't spend 19 years in prison. I'm not sure where that came from.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think it was like four, right, from what I remember from reading on your website?
Yes, it's four collectively, six with, you know, the recidivism, going back, checking the box. So, yeah, I was sentenced to 4 years at first, went back and did 19 months, so you got about six years there. I want to make sure we clear that up, because 19 years, any day.
Oh, 19 months. Okay, I'm sorry.
Months versus years. There you go.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
19 months for the violation for the recidivism part, and I'll break all that down. But, yeah, it's okay. It's all right. It's an honest mistake, but people do spend that kind of time, and we can talk about the doctoral sentences and how long women stay incarcerated versus men. Very educational opportunity right now, but definitely I wanted to clear that up because there are some sisters that we are fighting for that have done 19 plus 19 years behind bars. I think one of our sisters that was released probably about maybe a year ago, the longest standing woman was Gloria in New Orleans, Louisiana, and she spent 57 years. So it's the time is real.
Tia, let me ask you something.
That's like your whole life. That's crazy.
Yeah, those
I'm trying
are crazy.
To think about what would a person have to do to get that type of, because that's just terrible. And even then, that's the thing. I think that's what we do is we tend to try to make sense of other people's experience so that we justify in our mind that can never happen to us. And when you really kind of delve into why a person got pulled over, why a person, you know, was in jail that long, whatever the situation is, got shot, you know, when you find out, it's really, it could be any of us. Like in the end, it's not that they did sometimes do stuff that was absolutely justifiable, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. I wanted to say that, you know, and also sometimes when they print things, they print it wrong. They have 50 years, but she definitely, her name is Gloria Williams. You can look it up. She actually spent 57 years. So that's just to say it. Louisiana, you know, their rules and their laws are just a little bit more stricter than what we're dealing with. But, you know, the group of phenomenal women, doctors, lawyers, attorneys, PhD behind their name, some with master's degrees, just the experts is what we call ourselves. And then we teach language on how people will receive us and how we will be heard. So all is saying nothing about us without us. And that simply means that if you make anything that's going to accommodate us, anything that's going to stand for us, anything that we do, anything we need to be around, we have to be a part of it. So I just want to clear that up. Any day, if it's one day, 1,000 days or 100,000 days in jail, it's just too many. So, you know, it's unbearable for a woman to bear pregnancy and childbirth in prison like I did. So we can get into the forces or whatever you guys want to ask. I mean, I'm excited. So thank you, Kelly. Kelly is, you know, of course, a colleague on the campaign for Sherrod Beasley, and I enjoy working with her. I read about you as well and the fact that, you know, you are a doctor. I think that is phenomenal and amazing. We do appreciate, you know, the work that you and Kelly both are doing. I just say, you know, black women are always phenomenal and at the top of their game. And so thank you so much. I just wanted to share that, okay?
Yes, thank you.
T, I just want to ask you because, you know, you're the girl next door growing up. Tell me what life was like when you were younger.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so life for me when I was younger wasn't bad. I come from a family of love, you know. Overcoming generational poverty don't mean that you have a bad life. When you're in that stage as a child, you don't even really know that you're in that stage. My mom, who is my hero, always seemed to make life good and great at the level that we were at. You know, I come from a family of love. You'll never hear me say anything about neglect or abuse in my family because I come from a long line of phenomenal black women, including my matriarch, who I just lost 67 days ago, and her birthday is approaching. That's my mom's mom. But praying women in my life, women that go to church, women that are strong, women that are phenomenal. So as far as my childhood and my upbringing, I would have to say my mom made life seem like it was the best it could possibly be under those circumstances. So growing up as a child, I was loved heavily, heavily favored by my family, and I'm just supported in everything that I did. My mom was a mom that worked every day, that made sacrificial love for my sister and I, and always provided and made a way. Though the way that she provided, statistically, as we go back and we look at it, will show, according to guidelines and statistics, that it was poverty, because that's just what it is. But at the end of the day, when you come from a family of love, the way my mom did, working, caring for my sister and I came from a healthy line of love from black women. And there is no love like the love that you get from a black woman. Now, if you want to talk about being disobedient, making my own path, following people, going along with people that were in my environment, doing things that I saw other people doing, we can talk about that. That is the path that led me to incarceration because my family has a clean slate as it relates to incarceration. I am the first a person in my family that spent time, the only person in my family that spent time behind bars. Let me just go ahead and clear that up. So, you know, that was like a huge shocker and a disruption to my entire family to know that someone like myself, like Kelly said, I'm very positive, uplifting. When I walk in the room, my energy is what it is. It's like that every day. I continue to be the strong person that I am. I walk in leadership. I walk in love. I walk in light. The people that are in my life know that I walk in light, L-I-G-H-T, sound like I'm saying life, and light. I walk in light. And that simply means that I want everybody to be able to use their full potential to execute and reach the level that God has them at. I you know, my incarceration is known all over. I know your audience might be new to my incarceration. I know I have some people that are tuned in and listening as well, but I just want to share that. I want to share what my incarceration means to me today and why I use my testimony the way that I did. I would say that, you know, when I walk on this path, I always, you know, I have a good life, but I know that my pain that I went through in those dark days when I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, no matter how strong I am, how fierce I am, how many boards I sit on, how many advocations, organizations I advocate for, how many people I stand with in leadership and lead in this movement, there were dark days. And I said that when I get the opportunity to lead in the way that I lead, to be an effective leader, I will always make sure that I reach down and pull someone up to where I am, someone that's been through what I've been through that may not be able to know that there are better days. So I definitely want, you know, I'll take either right there and let you guys say if you have anything that you might want to say, anything you might want to ask. I'm open for all questions. The way I normally carry my story is, you know, my mom has always been there for me and my little sister. You know, my daughter was born inside a federal prison. And at the time when I went to prison, I wasn't going to keep my daughter. You know, my story is really, really deep. You know, I think I was kind of, you know, dealing with some mental wellness. You know, we all have to take care of ourselves. And if you can think someone at the age 20 going into prison, being a cheerleader at John C. Smith University, a track star, you know, scholastic and academically excelling, to take a fall like this was really like a shocker, like I said, to our family. We did not think that I was going to federal prison. We did not think that at all. So for me to have to go to federal prison was a damper on my entire family. But I will say that, you know, going inside and being pregnant, not wanting to deliver a child in federal prison, I did want to have an abortion. So I know people always talk about today, like, a woman's choice, you know, what we're dealing with right now in Supreme Court. You know, I think that a woman should have the right to choose. Mm-hmm. At that time, my mentality at 20 years old, going to prison, a two-year-old toddler at home, a 15-and-a-half-year-old high school student at home for my mom to raise. Keep in mind that my mom is going off of an income that is below the median. To say that you are above the poverty line, even though you go to work every day and you work hard and you can pay your bills and ends are being met, I still was in a community that was specifically based off income. Based off income, low-income housing still stands today. I know people have the words that you're born in the projects or you're born in the hood, you know, subsidized housing, what they say, or you're going to be in a community that's based off of your income. And if you can't pay a certain amount, then you get a median that you fall up under, and then you pay based off of what your income is and what you bring home, and as a portion that is applied to your rent so that you can have housing for you and your family. Just to break that down, I want to make sure that I'm clear when I say what that means to go inside of a neighborhood, because there's different tiers. My mom was in a tier where she worked every day, and they took a portion of her income and decided on what the rent would be. My mom always worked. She always was a hard worker. She always worked, and she always provided. So I want to make sure that I'm crystal clear on that on the show, because my mom was a phenomenal leader. She's still here. My mom is retired now. She retired from Novant Health, and she's an amazing, phenomenal Black woman that made sacrifice after sacrifice for my sister and I to be the phenomenal women that we are today.
Well, I definitely want to comment on one of the first things you mentioned, which was poverty, which kind of how you ended as far as poverty, that you're right. In the end, like, clearly poverty isn't connected to mental illness, just as it isn't connected to mental wellness and joy, because if it was, you would have the same level of mental health concerns that the United States struggles with in these, what they call third world countries that don't deal with this kind of stuff. You know, you could go to places, you know, in Mexico, Nicaragua, different places, you know, Africa, I'm sure. And the people have joy despite living in huts despite, you know, I mean, it's just amazing. Like, because like you said, you don't necessarily know what you don't know. Like, you don't, you know, the cultural influence on joy is just different. Like, it's clearly cultural. So it's clearly the case that, like, for example, in the U.S., the doctrine is like, you're beautiful if you look a certain way. You're successful if you dress a certain way, which is why there's this desire to sort of put on the front and get these certain pairs of shoes just to look like you got something. You know, you notice when people got something, they don't want to necessarily look like it. You know what I'm saying? They don't want to be the center of all the attention for whatever reason. While when those who don't have none, sometimes they're going extra with it. And, of course, in our household, it was something similar to what you're saying, which was that you can look like you got something and not have spent a lot of money on it. So, sure, we ain't walking around with no Jordans because that's just, like, not the – we weren't caught up in the cultural, like, influences. Like, we had our own mind in that sense. But my mom and the Ian knew how to, you know, come from the house we was coming from in Inglewood and – or west side of Chicago, because we lived in both neighborhoods, depending on what part of our lives we was in, and yet go downtown and fit right on in as far as dress goes, as far as, you know, professionalism, being in a law firm. So you hit the nail on the head with that comment. A lot of people, I don't think, know that. Even in mental health, they assume that, you know, it connects, and it doesn't. Poverty has nothing to do. There's rich people who dealing with mental health stuff. They jumping off buildings, you know. So, I mean, you know what I'm saying? And it's not to say that one person's better. It's just to literally say that ain't nobody, based on their financial situations, more healthier than another.
Tia, I wanted to ask you something because I know that there are moms listening. I know that there are probably some young girls that are listening to, maybe some college students that are listening to this show. And I wanted to go back into something that you said, which was really, really, really deep about the love of your parents. I mean, the love of your mom and the support that you got along the way. Even though you had the support of your love and your mom and everything, you said that there was that you followed some friends or you went a different pathway. How did you move in that direction?
So, I got involved with a guy that was heavily involved in narcotics. You know, you get attracted to, like, the material things, the money, the flashy cars, you know, hanging out, going different places, diamond rings, furs, all that stuff. You know,
in college?
In college, yeah. Are you serious? In the 90s? Yeah, absolutely. And it's probably still going on today. Kelly, remember, we came from two different worlds. We'll have to talk about that. But, yeah, I got in college.
Did your mom meet him?
My kid's dad. What do you mean did she meet him?
Oh, I didn't know. So did your mom ever think that he should not be... I mean, you should not date him, or she didn't say anything?
Of course. Did my mom not say anything? My mom was the epitome of doing the right thing. So my mom always said something. My mom always intervened. My mom always stood up what was right. You know, I was disobedient. You know, I made my own decisions, made my own rules, made my own path. My mom always stood for what was right. And I think a lot of times I lied. I lied about the lifestyle that I was living. I lied about the things that I was dealing with. I lied about the deep domestic violence that I was enduring at the hands of the person that, you know, was providing, who is the abuser, who I've forgiven today. You know, I can talk about this conversation because I have forgiven. That may be another subject for another day, but I have forgiven the person that was heavily abusing me, who is also the father of my two beautiful daughters. And I just want to say that, you know, the substance of, you know, your foundation always.
Yeah, some of the questions I ask you, like, you know, I might kind of have a feel for the answer, but I'm also asking for our audience because some of them may not be aware of this. But was there ever a time when you were thinking, like, this is too much, like, I want to leave during the process?
What, you mean domestic violence or what? Which part are you speaking of?
When you were involved in the relationship, when your mother was telling you no, Did you ever second guess it or start to think like maybe I shouldn't be here?
Of course I did, because I was heavily in a domestic situation. So I always thought that I should not be there, but I didn't have the strength or the power, didn't know how to leave. So when you're in a situation like people say, just leave, it gets under my skin, because you can't say just leave if you never walked in the shoes or the path of someone that has had to deal with domestic violence. It's easier to look on the outside and say, why don't you just leave? But it doesn't happen like that. It never really just happened like that. So, yes, absolutely. To answer to your question, is there many times I thought that I should have left.
Did you talk to anyone?
Professionally?
Did you tell
any
of your friends? Huh?
My friends knew that I was being abused. My friends in my immediate circle knew that I was going through a domestic situation. I lied about it to my mother and my immediate family and to my little sister's team, me being punched one day. And so that was the door opening to my mom finding out that I was being physically abused.
What did you do?
What do you mean, what did I do?
When she saw you being physically abused, what did you do? Did you say, I'm leaving, or did you stay?
Oh, I stayed. I didn't leave. I didn't leave. The only thing that saved me from the domestic relationship was my incarceration and his incarceration. I never found the strength to leave the incarceration. I think it was something greater than me. I had a praying grandmother, praying aunt, praying women that come from a long line of faith in my family that stand on the faith, that's a solid foundation for our family. I had people praying for me, for my strength, for a greater cause, a greater purpose, for me to live through all of it. And so I talk about my incarceration being a moment where God put me in time out to get me reactivated with my foundation and the fruits of the biblical beliefs and the foundation that my family come from, to be able to go back and say that, you know, I was saved for a greater cause is what I call it.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. Do you have, Coach KJ, do you have any questions in there about, like, the purpose of the type of incarceration? Because I know in her material she state very clearly white collar. So I want to make sure that, you know, that's sort of known, or, you know, that there's no room for speculation there for the listeners.
So, continue. So you were saying that basically the incarceration gave you purpose. You were there. Everybody was praying for you. It's kind of like a timeout. Did you ever think that you were going to be arrested through the process? Did that ever happen before you were actually arrested?
No, I didn't think I was going to go to federal prison. I didn't realize that the crimes that I had committed was against the United States of America. I learned about the system as I was going through the system. Again, age 19, when I started getting in trouble, and I started getting in trouble at age 16. Let me go back. I had a juvenile arrest record. I started getting in trouble at age 16. So I didn't think that I was going to end up in federal prison for white-collar crime, and I want people to know what white-collar crime is. White-collar crime is crime against the government for money, anything involved in fraud, bank, checks, credit card, manipulation of money, any instrument that is not anything dealing with violence. So it's anything that is like a corporation, funding, fraud, money, things of that, that will be considered a white-collar crime. A blue-collar crimes would be violence, drugs, and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to establish the consequences of what white-collar crimes produce and then what other crimes produce. But I also like to share with my listeners that it doesn't matter what you do. We have there are mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, and your criminal history are calculated, and that is determining your sentence, whether it's your first time or not. So there's a little different when you step on the federal government side. And so
You know, I learned about the federal government. I learned about going through the system as I was going through the system. You look at TV and you say, "Hell, what's going on TV? Is it really happening behind the walls of incarceration?" But every person in incarceration is probably going to be different based off of their mindset when they go in. But one thing we all know that black women are heavily incarcerated at a higher rate and disproportionately than the people that doesn't look like us, and I would say our white counterparts.
Is
that
Let me just ask Coach KJ, are you, and you're saying that, wow, so this, and we definitely got to get into the disproportionate rates because it's terrible. But you're saying also that, are you saying actually that the incarceration that occurred at 16 or the crime or whatever that occurred at 16, that was factored into this because you were saying something about they look at your history as well when calculating time, or because you was a minor that they not factor that in to how much time they gave you this 4 years?
So my juvenile record does not count.
Nice.
I brought that up to let people know when I started.
Right.
When I started to take a detour in life. I started early. I don't want parents listening to think that their children cannot get in trouble at an early age. The first time I was arrested, 16 years old. However, because I was 16 and it's a juvenile record, I had a deferred prosecution, which simply means that when you go through a justice program that they have for the courts, they do not go to jail if you do your community service and your probation is wiped. So my juvenile record was closed and sealed. Keep in mind, though, I don't know if I shared this, I was arrested anywhere between 28 and 30 times by the time I was 19 years old. So my first arrest at 16 went away. My arrest at 17 went away. But then I got arrested at 18 and 19 and went to federal prison at 20. So just think about all the times that I had been arrested collectively from the ages of 16 to 20 years of age before I was sentenced to my federal incarceration sentence.
So, okay, so then what would have factored into the 4 years? So what would have been factored into the 4 years would have been then those arrests that happened once you was an adult, like the 18 before the 20, 18 and 19? Okay. I'm just kind of trying to figure out how was you able to get into so much quote-unquote trouble when you was in college, right? You was in college, you said, right?
Yeah, so people get in college every day. Let me just share with you, while I was in college also, there was a young man on college campus that was going through trials for a murder, you know, conspiracy. He was a football player. There was also another young man that was a college and popular football player at Johnson Smith University. This is at JCSU, Johnson Smith University, in Charlotte, North Carolina, from the years of 1992 to 94. This guy also was dealing with some white-collar crimes and dealing with some things that dealt with, like, division of motor vehicles. So don't think that because your children are in school, they're going to school, they're doing everything they're supposed to do. The key to that is going to be getting in their business and making sure you know what they do. You know, my mom was in my business. But
say that again. Say that again for people who didn't listen. What do they need to do?
They need to make sure that they are in constant communication with their children and making sure they know what their business is and what their agenda is, why they are in college. A lot of kids go away to school, and so the communication tends to be distinct between the parents or the caregivers or the guardians and the students. And a lot of times the students start to get in cliques and groups, and they start to learn what other people are doing and start to adapt to their habits. That peer pressure and hanging around people that come from different environments and trying to fit in is real. I just want to share that. It's real.
And I wanted to tell you that when I dropped my daughter off at college, when I took her to college, the first thing they told me and told the other moms was, don't be a helicopter mom. Like, don't continue to circle in. I was like, look, call me helicopter, call me 747, call me whatever. I'm going to be checking in. I don't care. I'm checking in. And you know what? I thank and praise God for an amazing daughter who was not, you know, who did not push back. But, yeah, you do have to stay on top of your child. You know, you do have to stay on top of things just to make sure that everything is good. Let me ask you this. During the process, was there anything looking back today at everything that you did? I mean, with your parents, I mean, with your mom and, you know, moving to college, et cetera, was there anything that you think could have been done to break that cycle? And I'm asking that for moms who are listening or parents who are listening that may be wondering what can they do when they see similar activity with their children.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, repeat that one more time, I'm sorry.
So when you said you were arrested multiple times, do you think there's anything that could have been done to make you stop doing what you're doing before you stop?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you make decisions as a young person. You know, there are consequences that come with those. Yeah, I could have stopped. You'd be obedient and you stop, right? You know, you make a decision to move forward with something that is not right, and then there are consequences that come with that. Anything that could have made me stop, I could have stopped myself. I mean, I could have been obedient and listened to my mom, but I think the peer pressure and the adrenaline for getting so much money at such an early age and kind of just, mm-hmm. you know, outsmart the system. So I thought at that time was the push that I needed to go through, you know, the fancy mm-hmm. clothes, the diamonds, the attention that I was getting at that time was all mm-hmm. for me moving forward and continuing to make the decisions that I made. I speak with youth, I mentor, I give back, I pour back into the community to share with people that, you know, in that moment you may make a decision that is temporary and it seems to be fulfilling mm-hmm. at that moment, mm-hmm. but there's a high consequence to pay for it. And also, it follows you for a very, very long time. Being mm-hmm. inside of the federal incarceration system or the Bureau of Prisons, which is acronym at BOP, it follows mm-hmm. me forever. You can Google my name, and it mm-hmm. will tell you that I've been incarcerated for this amount of time and my release date. So you mm-hmm. never really get out of a system that mm-hmm. is built, you know, on racism, on Jim Crow, on
yes.
Systemic barriers for Black people. Mm-hmm. We are all under that umbrella. And so even though mm-hmm. I am out of federal prison and have been out for 17 and a half years, I have a fine that exceeds mm-hmm. $400,000. And my paycheck is garnished every month to pay back mm-hmm. restitution. So even though I say that I'm out of the system, I'm really not out of the system. There's some things that, you know, that are attached to me that mm-hmm. is going to always be attached to me because I've been inside of that system. I can say I detached myself from it in the spiritual realm of things because I move forward and I don't let my past define who I am. But if we go back mm-hmm. statistically and we go back historically, things are still in place to keep us inside that system. And I don't think mm-hmm. I talk about, mm-hmm. you know, how I'm affected from an incarceration. My daughter, my youngest daughter now is mm-hmm. 28. My oldest daughter is 30. So when you think mm-hmm. back all the time when I really got discharged, you're talking about almost 3 decades ago, but I'm still paying money back to a mm-hmm. carceral system every month, being garnished, being flagged for educational funding, mm-hmm. Certain grants that I don't qualify for. I am a 7K mm-hmm. now that I'm back in school studying criminal justice, and I want to pursue my law degree. These are things.
And tell her
what
your GPA is. Tia, I'm sorry. Tell her what your GPA is, please.
My GPA is a 4.0.
Wow.
4.0, even with all of the obstacles that are put in place for me not to be successful. So, I I tell people I don't have an innocent story, but my mm-hmm. story still does
not give the criminal justice mm-hmm. or injustice system a pass for how it represents black people and how we mm-hmm. are disproportionately incarcerated at a higher rate than any other race. And it's something mm-hmm. that is not surprising, mm-hmm. and it's known globally, and that mm-hmm. throughout the world that mm-hmm. we are scarred by the criminal justice system, and that laws are put in place mm-hmm. and barriers are put in place to keep us there. I'll tell you about mm-hmm. a story. I have, and there's a white ally that works on my team. She mm-hmm. tells this story, and we go out. She say, "I have a white son. He comes from privilege. We live in a community mm-hmm. where the home started at $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
My son has a gun, and my son has some marijuana in the car. The police officer pulled my son over, brought my son home, knocked on the door, and said, 'I have your son, you have a gun, and you have drugs.' And so mm-hmm. my white ally says, take my son to jail." And the mm-hmm. police officer looks at him and says, this white police officer looks at this white woman who's telling them to take her white son to jail. And they say to her, and she say to them, "Are you crazy? We're doing you a favor. We don't want, mm-hmm. you know, your son to be arrested. You know what an arrest racket can do to him?" She says, "Yes, the same mm-hmm. thing that it does all of the black children that do not get this opportunity. So take my mm-hmm. son to jail."
Wow.
These wow. are things that go on when you have privilege and you have money that we may not always see. And mm. I just always like to share that. And she shared that story sometimes when we travel and we speak. And she'll say how she said to the officer, "What you're doing right now is breaking the law, but I'm not going to mm. allow you to do that because my son needs to be taught mm-hmm. a lesson." Our son's looking at her like she's crazy. The police officers are looking at her like she's crazy. But this is what she's saying to them. You bend mm-hmm. the law when you implement privilege because my son's mm-hmm. skin tone is the right color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Look, it's terrible. In the end, I just don't want it to be that you're saying this and people just got to take your word for it. Like, there's all type of numbers that can be found or information on this topic that could be found. Like, first of all, I looked up Gloria Williams. You're talking about Googling you, but I looked up her when you mentioned her name, and I put 57 years in prison. And it's crazy. It says that she was in prison. She's been in prison for nearly 50 years. It says in 1971, she and several others robbed a grocery store with a toy gun after a struggle with the store owner. It says after a struggle with the store owner who was armed, someone in her group shot the owner with his own gun. It says she was 25 years old, the mother of five children, and sentenced to prison basically for the rest of her life in this Louisiana state prison that's saying that, you know, it's the longest serving incarceration, you know, of a woman that they have in their history. And I'm looking up numbers.
Of a black
woman. Yep, and then I'm looking on numbers on, like, just incarceration rate, you know, racial makeup specifically of Americans in prison, and it's terrible. It's saying, you know, that black people represent over 50% of the prison population, that we're five times more likely to be arrested than a European American. It's talking about how, like, despite black people making up 12% of, for example, the nation's drug users, that right. they represent 34% of those arrested for drug offenses. Like, that's almost like you just looking for a reason, you know, to
right.
just arrest people. Like, it's just terrible. And when you talked about Jim Crow and all of that, the first thing I thought about was the fact that, like cops used to literally their use as it related to us would be to hang us or to capture us when we run away, and to either beat us and bring us back or to hang us and maybe
right.
sexually, you know what I'm saying, assault.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so when you think about now, the it's almost like just searching out people. Just, I don't know. I've never had personally, like, for myself, but connected to my husband, a messed up experience with a cop before. But I, it's something, because that happened one time, and yet, because I know what could be because of what is, you know, I'm like uncomfortable even, you know, when one pulls up next. So it's, there's something real. That's why people be like, oh, why didn't you just, you know, they tell us about it all the time. Like if the cop tells you to get out of your car, why wouldn't you? Because there's a 98% chance that you're going to be killed, like shot. Like this is a question that they would ask us in Wisconsin when we was up there for a couple of years, you know.
Absolutely. And we're so, and I think that it takes more than one podcast to explain incarceration as it starts in our school to prison pipeline, where they target young children at the age 3, preschool, and start suspending them and lead them into a path of where they're being rejected. We want to make sure that people know exactly what happens when when people start to talk about our incarceration rate.
Yeah, like this is like targeted. This is like purposeful. Like, because how do you, I mean, that's just crazy. Like, it's almost like it's just crazy. So, yeah, I mean, it is, and it does with school. Like, I mean, that's serious to think like that what you're taught in school impacts what you will become. Like, think about those studies that identify the impact of teachers' perception of the student on then the student's performance behavior in the school setting. Like, that stuff is real, you know? And then if you're not taught nothing, your scores are low. I mean, it's crazy. When I think of CPS's school system, if you're not a selective enrollment school, your students, you can't really get excited about their all A's or their all B's. I mean, you can on, like, on a personal level, because it's a reflection of your child's work ethic, right? Their responsibility, right? But in the end, that's part of why we got to, on some level, work harder when we didn't get to college in hopes that we don't flunk out. Because, you know, even me, myself, I mean, a doctor, just a little bit of self-disclosure, like I end up having to take a 0-100 level math class coming into college, because, which would be like a high school level class, because I didn't do well on that entrance exam, you know, and thankfully my school had the mind to accept me with my scores, you know?
Yeah, but you're a doctor today, so you've overcome that challenge as well. And so that's something that you can use to move forward and let our children know that they can become doctors in spite of, you know, I let people know. And so, my incarceration, though, I don't have an innocent story. What I like to do, you know, my daughter's friends, they like to say that, you know, my mom, you know, their friends like to say, well, Miss Brown is the GOAT, you know. So, they're saying that, you know, you're able to achieve anything greater than your purpose, no matter what you've been through. That's what I look at when people call me the GOAT, that they see a black woman that has been scarred, that has been bruised, that has been broken, that has been down, but didn't stay that way. And what I like to tell people is I like to help reimagine and prevent our children from going through what I've been through, and to give hope to other black women that are coming home from incarceration. And though I represent women and girls, I also mentor young men. I have intervened and been in court watch and helped a few of our black brothers come home. I have built relationships with our community leaders, with the people that are in the chambers, our judicial leaders, our judges, our federal and state judges, our local, federal and state probation officers. I like to implement programs that reimagine and replace incarceration, to dismantle those systems that do not correct the behavior that you have when you go in with. You know, incarceration is made to do two things. One is to rehabilitate you and to keep the public safe. I'm going to ask you as a doctor, because you're wise and you're intelligent, what do you think happened when I went inside a federal prison age of 20 years old, a black young girl, cheerleader, honor student, pregnant, went to prison. I told you the two things prisons are supposed to do. Keep the community safe and rehabilitate.
Yeah.
What do you think happened to me when I went inside.
I bet on a systemic level that there was no manner of rehabilitation except that you tried, you read books, you, if anything, I would think that if there is any desire to address your mental health issues, that it would have been from a psychiatric as opposed to from a psychological standpoint, so where that would have been drug management as opposed to actually getting to the root of what got you there, your history, how to basically heal from this, you know, so that it would never happen again.
Well, you hit it right on the money. There's no rehabilitation at all under no circumstances. Self-rehabilitate is what we did. We connected with like minds. You had women going into the law library that became lawyers inside of there. You had women that become ministers, that become ministers, that become moms, children, that have lost their moms. Maybe, you know, they've been implemented inside of love through the abuser or the drug dealer, that they may be on their case, and they get all these law sentences. They're sentenced to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, even life inside of incarceration. I want you to look up another lady. I dare not leave any podcast without she is my friend. Her name is Michelle West. And if you just Google Free Michelle West and read her story, we're fighting to bring her home now. But I always, when people ask me, what do you think is, what did you learn from being incarcerated? What I learned from being incarcerated is that they don't care about us, that the doors are open wide, and that they are revolving, and that you can go out and you can come back in. You can go out and you can come back in because the resources that we need are not here. But what I learned with the bold and courageous leadership and the phenomenal women that I'm connected to, I've learned to stand independently in our own space unapologetically for what we stand in and what we represent and how we want to move forward, helping our other sisters and our brothers escape the walls of incarceration, not being scarred by the language, ex-felon, convicted felon, convict, you know, all those words that degrade us, that dehumanize us, we a language that we will respond to. And it's, I am a mother. I am a grandmother. I am a daughter. I am a leader. I am a aunt. I'm a cousin. I'm a sister. You know, I am all these things other than what the system has labeled us to be. I've been able to be so strong, so firm, and so positive because I know that I could be my sisters that are incarcerated with 30, 40, 50 years, even Michelle West, the life sentence plus 50 years that we're fighting for. So instead of dwelling on what I did wrong or the things that kept me down when I was in that dark space, I want to move forward and holding up my hand and say, hey, sister, I've been where you've been. But let me tell you about my walk to get out of that space, to reach back and help another sister, to prevent the school-to-prison pipeline, to interrupt that system that wants to drag all of our youth in and say that they're just like the zip code that they were born in or the environment that they were born in that they have no control over. I want our children to know, even though you may not get but one meal a day or your shoes may be shoes that you have to wear to have holes in the bottom of them, you can overcome that. And we're here to show you how to do that. That is what I want our children to know, that it doesn't matter that your family may be on public assistance and your mom may have to leave the home to work two or three jobs. We're still going to be here to build that village, that double village, and that community of organizations and grassroots that implement and do early prevention and intervention for our youth. And that's why I'm here, you know, not for anybody to say, you know, what you did was wrong. I don't have an innocent story. I know that. But I tell my story is my truth, and that's my power. I tell it so no one can take my power away from me, and that's how I've been able to hold on and build this stronghold that I have in my faith, because my power is my truth, and that's my story.
Wow. Hey, Tia, I just want to ask you something, because once again, this story, this podcast is really about stories of triumph and how we get to the next step. Mm-hmm. What was the thing that you think made the change for you? Like, you know, I'm moving forward. And then what was the affirmation? Because sometimes people need the affirmation to continue going.
Mm-hmm. So the thing that said I was going to move forward is I wanted something greater. I knew that, you know, I wasn't being fed in regular jobs. I wasn't being fed in hiding behind my incarceration, hiding behind the embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that people will take your story and they will tell it if you don't. And I knew that that's my power. If anybody's going to tell my story, I'm going to tell it. So once I started telling my story, I had the power to move forward. You know, you say about affirmations and what people know to be true and hopeful. You got to understand that some people don't even know what it means to move forward. You know, the affirmation is going to be what you do in the process of something that is being confirmed. You know, I want to tell my story. But what actions am I going to put in place? Although I'm telling my story, what affirms my story? What affirms my story is the benefit of telling my story for other people to move forward with theirs. To be able to say, if she did, I can do it too. I don't have a special story. I don't have a special story. Everybody that's on the sound of my voice or your voice or the doctor's voice, Kelly, can say, I have a story that will encourage or discourage anybody. The problem or the concern or the need for that story is what you do, how you declare it. To be able to assert it in certain environments and know that you're implementing something that's greater than yourself, and that's the affirmation that you'll have to be able to take that action and move forward so that other people can do the same thing. You have to walk.
Here, do you think – I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, do you think that being in such a loving and affirming environment, meaning like your family, do you think that helped you to tell your story or even to formulate your story? Because sometimes people don't know how to put their story together.
Okay, so everybody don't have to physically tell their story. You can help behind the scenes. You got to understand trauma, childhood anxiety, all of those things, even though I said I came from a family of love, when we take the child ACE assessment, I scored significantly high.
That makes sense.
You know that there's some things that were added that I may not have been able to see and implement in my story at that time. Remember I said, even though I overcame generational poverty at that time, I did not even know that I was in poverty. Because of all the love that was around me. So you're right. How do people take and validate and even to be able to confirm that it's the right thing that they're doing? Now, I'm not a counselor. I just say I'm an expert of lived experience. Okay? That just simply means I've been through something in life. I'm transparent. My life is an open book. I share what worked for me. As a generous statement, everybody has to find their own path to healing. Now, I will tell you, my healing is sharing my story and seeing other young women say, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it, because you shared your story with me. You gave me an example of what I could do to move forward. That is my healing. That is standing in my truth, something that's greater than myself, to be able to say, I'm going to give back. Because remember, Kelly, I heard you. Remember I said, I don't have to do this. My life is good. I choose to do this.
I was just going to say, Tia, I know you say that you know, people can say I made it out, et cetera. The thing that really strikes me about you is just how positive you are. I mean, like, you are the cheerleader. And please forgive me, Dr. Valentina, I'm not – Tia is very humble. I can't think of an employee in our group that has not gone to Tia and talked to Tia, and she has not uplifted them. So, yes, it's one thing to tell your story, but the love, excitement, and the energy that people leave with after talking to you is the fire that I'm talking about. You know, I thank you. No, wait. Take your flowers. I thank you for what you've done for me personally in our conversations. I thank you for what you've done in our work environment personally. And like I said, some people have that power that you have. I mean, we're all equipped with some power. God gives us all gifts and talents. But I think a part of the challenge sometimes is for people to channel it and understand how to use their story. Was there anyone in particular that coached you along the way, or was it just your prayer with God? And let me just say this. The reason why I'm asking you this is, once again, we want people to leave with nuggets on how they can move forward. Was there anyone that coached you along the way, or was it just your relationship with God? And what would you encourage people to do moving forward? Because we're about to close.
Well, it's the foundation of my family. I come from a family of love, and I know everybody don't know what love is. I know sometimes family is painful to people. Sometimes when you say family, they go the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
And even when they don't have anybody, everybody has somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be family.
Right.
I would say find one person that you can talk to. If it's a teacher, it's a friend, it's somebody in the church, if you're in the church, somebody in the community that you trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if someone under the sound of my voice don't trust anybody, then you got to go into some type of organization and become a part of something that is like yourself. Even if it starts with trying to figure out where you belong.
Mm-hmm.
You can Google things on the internet.
It.
Like healing groups, how to move forward. When you know, the internet, let's be honest, that's our friend. That's technology, that's our friend. Start there. I want to leave away with, because I gotta say this. I came from love, but everybody don't.
Mm-hmm.
I came from love, but everybody don't. Some mothers, you know, are reminds people of pain and anger, you know, as real as it is. So I want you to know the nuggets that I leave people with is that your story is your power.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you've been through. Your story is your power, and you might not can't see it right now. I just want people to know that I have not always been this strong. I lied. My family disowned me. My family didn't trust me. You know, my family was upset with me. My family, you know, I caused embarrassment, you know, to my family. I was going to have an abortion. I contemplated suicide and how I was going to do it and how I was going to go through with it. There were I was in a dark space. I want people to know, reading the story and seeing all these accolades, I was in a dark, dark, dark space. But you have to be able to dig deep. And you have to be able to turn those negatives into positives. We are only here for a short time. And it's very short. I mean, it's so short that, like, I can get off this podcast and that could be it. God could call me home. It happens every day. I say that we got to be able to add credible value to the lives of people that are in our circle, that immediately right there in front of us.
Yeah.
How do you do something with affirmation and you tell people that they can do better? People may not even know what better looks like. You have to give people examples, and you have to be authentic and intentional. You know, I said I'm going to be more intentional. Kelly said I'm positive. I received those flowers. Kelly, thank you so much. It's a blessing to have you in my life, and I thank you guys for doing this podcast. But I always like to leave people with one thing, and that's the power to move forward when they leave a conversation with me. And on this podcast, mission accomplished. I always want to leave people power to move forward.
somehow, some way.
Wow, this is huge. I'm so glad.
See, that's what life is. That's what life is about, and that's what our purpose, everyone's ultimate purpose is to help people move forward. Whether you help them with a small thing, a smile, a laugh in the moment, or you help them long term, you know, that is the goal, because it's contagious. You know what I mean? If I help you move forward, then you're going to help the next person move forward, and it's contagious. And sometimes we might run into somebody that has nobody out there helping them move forward. Well, I know you said that everybody has somebody, but they have not acknowledged or recognized or embraced the person that can help them move forward. So you might be that
tool. And that's why that's the tool of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
I think this is.
Well, Tia, you are fire and you're inspiration. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now and what's next and how we can get in touch with you?
Well, I want people to know this. We're moving forward with your power.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to know they can write about things that they want to change.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be long and drawn out. Take baby steps.
Mm-hmm.
And be real.
Mm-hmm.
Be real in your writing. And that way, it gives you the power to say, I accomplished this today.
Yes.
Tomorrow, I'm going to try this. And guess what? If it doesn't work, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Do it again and again and again and again, and it will work.
It's true.
I can be real. All things is beauty after the bars. You can Google beauty after the bars, Instagram, Facebook.
Yes.
Everything is beauty after the bars. And I want people to know my bars is the prison bars and domestic violence and overcoming this incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
Your bar could be taking baby steps to taking care of my mental well-being, self-love, leaving a relationship that is not healthy, leaving a circle of friends that are not elevated. Your bar can be anything, but just remember that whatever bar you're under today, you don't have to be under that bar tomorrow.
That's so true.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
see,
I have to say, I have to say this too, Kelly. I have to say this, that I looked up you before, of course, today, when Kelly told me that we had you for today, and the listeners definitely need to look up beautyafterthebars.com and just look at the Meet the Founder, start there. It's a trip. Like, the fact that you have, you know, this whole formerly known as Federal Prisoner Number 1056, I'm like, wow, like, woo! And then I looked up, of course, you said it was, what was it, hashtag Free Michelle West, and same thing, it's got her, like, number on here and her story, and it is, when you look at this case, like, it's not enough to just be like, our people, our black people are incarcerated, clearly, so many times more, five times more, that, you know, it's, we know this is something that's orchestrated. It's you have to go deeper and, like you said, tell people's individual story so that they can see that, like, this is clearly unfair, unjust, like, you know, because when you hear the story of what occurred, it don't make no sense for her to have, you know, this life sentence. Like, this is just dumb, you know? So,
right.
In the end, what you said about people telling their story. Uh-oh, go ahead.
No, I say it's real. People need to know that incarceration in black women is real.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the impact that it has, like you said, the ACEs, I don't know if people caught that, but ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. And there are basically, this study was done about a decade or more, you know, actually it might have been in the 70s or something, but it really came out about a decade ago. This concept of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences that basically impact people if unresolved, if go undealt with, into their adulthood, so that people end up dealing with homelessness, or they deal with even the everyday stuff like cancer. Really, that's an everyday thing. Substance abuse. Like, I mean, it is rough. So it tells you that out of these 10, which could be divorce, it could be maternal depression, it could be somebody in your household had a severe mental illness. It could be that you were sexually abused or emotionally abused or physically abused, feeling unwanted or unloved, unsafe, witnessing abuse. Like, there's just a bunch of them. But if you have
incarceration,
yeah,
I read about post-incarceration syndrome. And they were saying that 95% of people who leave prison have post-incarceration syndrome, which would be, please forgive me, paranoia, anxiety, or PTSD.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, there were a lot of things that I read. That there was also, you know, which I'm very, very big on suicide and mental health. It was saying that basically University of Washington did a study, and people spent time in prison were 62% more likely to commit suicide than the rest of the population. After one arrest, it was 42%. After two arrests, it was 67%. And then after three or more arrests, it was 113%. But I want to tell you something. Tia is, which I don't know if we said this beforehand because my phone was cut off. That's why you guys didn't hear from me for a while. I couldn't figure out how to get back on. But Tia also ran for political office. Can I say that, Tia?
That's fine. Yes.
She's run for political office. She's doing things with shelter with women. Can you just tell a little? That's what I meant. Can you tell a little bit about what you're doing right now before you leave?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and say that. You know, right now what I'm doing is I have a home. I've been granted an award through Safe Housing Network with Susan Burton out of Los Angeles, California. Been given a grant to provide housing for women that are coming home from incarceration, a safe home for them, a safe place for them to come and stay. So I have that grant. I have Beauty After the Bars Mentoring, where I mentor young women and women that are inside the county jail. Like programs I'm writing to help them deal with their stress or their childhood ACEs that they never dealt with, domestic violence, certified in domestic violence prevention, helping women and counseling there.
Wow.
I'm also a North Carolina Certified Peer Support Specialist, and I'm also a North Carolina Certified Community Healthcare Worker. I work on Sherry Beasley's campaign as the Regional Director in Constituents and Community Service. I'm self-employed for myself. I work for American Airlines. I have multiple streams of income. I'm the mother of two beautiful daughters, Antoinette and Tajima. My sister and her family live in Maryland. My only baby sister, Shantae, and her family live in Maryland. My mom, who's Artie Brown, is here, and then you know, my aunt and my cousins and all my family and friends that support me here. So I'm doing a lot of things. My hand is in a lot of stuff, but ultimately I want people to leave here knowing if they don't have anybody, then they have me. Beauty After the Bars, if they can just reach out to me, I try to help in whatever way I can. If I'm not able to help, I extend the resources to all the other organizations that I partner with and the wraparound services that I offer. There is someone for everybody, and we will make sure that we match you up with that person.
Wow, that is excellent. Hey, that is so excellent. And let me ask you this before. I know it sounds like we're about to leave soon. I just have to, you know, we didn't really get into, like, the mental health stuff and all of the impacts, you know, deeply, but I'm so glad that you was able to at least identify for people, like, you know, the different things that you struggle with so that they would know that they're not alone. I mean, it really is powerful to tell your story, not only because for you it's sort of healing, but for them it's like there's no – it's almost like the power that the enemy would have, and I'm talking about spiritual enemy, would have, you know, as far as producing guilt and shame and the depression and anxiety that could come with that is almost obliterated and destroyed when you tell your story, because it's confirming for that individual that they aren't alone, which then it doesn't allow the spirit of depression to sort of attack them, because now they have a family to go to, they got a group to go to, they got people to talk to, you know. So I think that was a huge nugget right there. This whole concept of telling your story, like tell it, share it. Don't be ashamed. Sure, don't tell it to anybody. You know, you can't tell it to people who you don't trust, but
for right, to people who are looking for help, to people that show some level of signs that, you know, they're going through some of what you're going through, that needs to be heard. And then another thing I wish we was able to kind of get into was kind of just exploring your any kind of daddy history, because you spoke a lot about black women and the influence of black women, and it's something how those that is who helped you and that's who you sort of like are now helping as you see that this group is being, you know what I'm saying, like attacked. But I think that, you know, that is something that I'm sure listeners caught, because I caught that there was some talk about dad. And so I just wonder, you know, because I know that the impact on your life, I know that impact, generally speaking, is great. This is part of why systematically men were imprisoned and forced out of the home, and women could only get support governmental if the dad went in the home, you know, stuff like that. So,
Dr. Valentina?
Know,
Dr.
Yes.
Valentina, I'm sorry. I want to leave this on a very, very positive note. T, I'm going to ask you to close us out with one more thing before we leave.
Yes.
Dr. Valentina, based on what you were saying right now, Tia is a public speaker. She's a nationally known public speaker. She's worked with various leaders, various presidents, et cetera. Why don't you invite her to Charlotte? You have her to Chicago. You have her information. You can invite her up for a public speaking engagement, and she can help some of the people that you and help some of the people and answer some of the questions that you're talking about. Tia gave me a very hard stop at 11 o'clock, so I thank you so much for
tell me stuff. I would have planned my questions earlier. I'm thinking 90 minutes, like usual. No wonder.
Dr. Valentina. So I want to say thank you once again, Tia, for giving us a couple extra minutes. Can you please just close us out with something love you, Tick. Just give us something.
I love you guys, and thank you so much for that. I did give you a hard stop at 11 o'clock, but, you know, sometimes you go over and you just let the spirit and the atmosphere move in the direction that it is. I definitely am open to coming to Chicago. I will leave with this note. The way you start is definitely not the way that you have to finish. And in life, we're going to always endure things that seem, you know, that are hard, that are maybe seem like barriers to overcome, challenging. You got to figure out how you can get through. And you may not know how to get through, but there's always someone that can help push you through. I like to say that in this life, and I want to just, you know, be mindful, my father died early. But, you know, in black communities, when you were born in generational poverty, fathers were absent by choice, you know. You know, you're having children out of wedlock, and so the father was not around. My mom wasn't married to my dad, so my mom was my father, and my mom was my mother. And so we made it through. I see a long line of black women, because a lot of times when you're dealing with children that come from generationals or a housing project, a lot of times they're single-parent homes, and I just wanted to share that. But it doesn't mean anything. They still can be the next president, the next Congress lady, the next doctor, the next lawyer, the next Wall Street investor, the next person to have multiple streams of income, just like all of these phenomenal leaders that we know with Amazon and Apple and Elon Musk that owns Tesla. Our children are capable of doing anything. We just need to make sure that we stand firm and supporting them and pour positivity into them, and all the worries that they see, all the negative stuff going on, just keep pushing forward. No matter what, I say I leave with this. You have the power to move on. Everybody has the power to move on. You've got to find what that power is.
Yes, I love it. I love it. You know how we feel? Leave uplifting and leave on a positive note. Tia, you are beautiful and fabulous, and I thank you so much for your time. Dr. Valentina, always powerful, exciting, engaging, energetic conversation. I love what you bring to the table, and I thank you so much, Kim Justice, for this opportunity to engage guests and hopefully provide light, inspiration, and once again, foundational steps to move forward. Thank you so much, everybody, and have a good evening.
You too.
Take care.
Good night.
Good night.